Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago. I am joined today by Rob Hunt of Lanay Holdings out in lovely San Diego. We have David Ellison of the Scarlet Fire Cannabis Company as our guest today. And in honor of that, and just because why the hell not, we've got some great music. We got a lot of music. Dan, we're diving in right now. Go. Well, if you guys like Grateful Dead music more than you like listening to us talk, today is the day because we're doing Scarlet Fire. We have a guest who has a store in up in Toronto called the Scarlet Fire Cannabis Company. We're going to get to him in one moment. But Rob, what do you think about that as a great way to kick off a Scarlet Fire themed show?
10-14-83, man. I love it. And I absolutely love what Brent does in that intro because it's completely unique. You know, you're not really waiting, not expecting it. All of a sudden it kicks in almost like a wood, what do you call that instrument? It's not a steel drum, but it just has that cool like knocking noise to it. But it's so unique that Brent plays that way. And the other thing I'll say is I don't know what it is about the date, October 14th, but October 14th produces Hot Scarlet Fires. So I am ready to talk about Scarlet Fire, and I'm definitely ready to talk about Scarlet Fire with our guest, David Ellison.
Yes, as am I. For those of you who enjoy that and want to hear more of that version of Scarlet Fire that we were just listening to, let me direct you to Dick's Picks number 6. So you're going back a few years in the dead releases here. But this is probably the Dick's Picks that for me really cemented my commitment to what they were releasing. It was a 1983 show. In fact, this show is just a few nights after the Dead debuted, brought back out St. Stephen in the Garden. And I believe the very next night up in Hartford, they pulled it out a second time before retiring it out on the West Coast. But this was like, you know, my coming of age years with the Grateful Dead. And that's just what a great example of Scarlet Fire. With that, Rob, please introduce our guest today.
Well, we are really fortunate to be joined by David Ellison today, who owns a very cool shop up in Toronto, Canada, called Scarlet Fire Cannabis Co. He was introduced to us through our guest from last week, from Stacy Smith. So thanks and shout out to Stacy for making the introduction. But David, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's our pleasure.
Let's kick it off. Let's talk about, I know you're an attorney in a past life and you kind of made the migration over to cannabis. How did you make that switch and what was the catalyst?
I was a corporate securities lawyer for about 20 years and I started doing cannabis deals in 2014. And I took the first U.S. cannabis company public in Canada, which closed in late 2015. And then cannabis deals just started rolling in from there. But in terms of capital markets, cannabis was really had gone 12 innings in a 9-inning ball game. Given that my practice was heavily weighted in cannabis deals, I decided to move from being a lawyer to being a business person. And I married two real passions of mine, which are the Grateful Dead and cannabis.
Well, I would say that would make you the perfect guest for our show. It doesn't get any better than that, especially when the name of your company is the Scarlet Fire Cannabis Company. Yeah, this is a guy you want on. So thank you so much for joining us. As we were joking with you at the beginning, Rob and I both as attorneys have long been taking a look at that road. Rob's a little bit farther down it than I am. But by God, David, before we let you off the air today, you're going to give me the secret, and I'm going to be joining you on that side of the fence, because what a great thing to be able to wake up every day and, you know, just be out there going to work in the cannabis industry and be, you know, be a big part of it. How did you get your company from, you know, the idea in your head, you know, out onto the floor and opening the doors?
Well, you know, as you would imagine, Larry, and as well, you, Rob, selling weed is way more fun than drafting documents. So... So, sure. So in the Grateful Dead, I guess, ethos, you know, I wanted to have fun. I wanted to spend, you know, I spent a lot of years making rich people richer. I really, you know, I guess really during the beginning of the pandemic, I started to think about how I can make a better contribution to this world. And that better contribution, I thought, was to improve the quality of people's lives with cannabis, which really was the founding principle of Scarlet Fire. I sat down one day with a piece of paper and said, you know, how can I make a better contribution to this world? And the one that stuck was to improve people's improve the quality of people's lives with cannabis.
Wow, man, maybe we should bring you on as a host of the show. That's pretty great. You know, I have to say, I love that philosophy. And, you know, good for you for, you know, I think there's many of us that have gone out on Friday afternoons at the end of a long, hard week with our contemporaries and sat around over a few or more drinks, you know, waiting for the last train to go home and have had that conversation. And, you know, we all talk about it. Not everybody does it. So it's great to see that you've done it. And it's great to see the theme that you've adopted. And by God, you've given me more reason to go back up to Toronto now, other than just, you know, to go to the Hockey Hall of Fame. So this is great. Well, and
You know, it's actually one, you know, I was never a big drinker. But, you know, as you know, practicing law, the thing to do after work or on a Friday is go out to drink. And after work, I used to go to these bars and I see people drinking. And I was thinking to myself, like, how miserable does your life have to be that you got to drink booze after work, right? Right? Like, wouldn't you rather go home and, like, light a joint?
I can't agree with you more. And, you know, I consider myself very lucky, because even though I'm a little bit farther along in life than, you know, I might have hoped, as all of this is finally coming out and into the forefront, boy, how different life might have been, right? If this had all been happening, you know, 20 or 30 years ago when we were all, you know, really just diving into this thing. But I can only imagine where it's going to get to a point like you've just suggested, where, you know, it will be possible to go out with your professional colleagues and some people will have a drink, some people will light up a smoke, and, you know, anybody can do whatever they want to do. And the folks who want to drink, they, you know, look, that, God bless them. That's their business. That, you know, just leaves more marijuana for the rest of us.
That's right. And as, you know, we get, I mean, we're still way in our infancy, but as things move along and as the stigma towards cannabis use starts to change, you know, I think we're going to see more access to consumption areas or consumption lounges or cannabis bars or things like that. Right now in Ontario, at least, you can consume cannabis anywhere you can smoke a cigarette. So you can walk down the street, smoke a joint, go to a park, smoke a joint, drink a cannabis beverage in the park, anywhere you want, which is great. Cause to me, that's freedom. Right. And when we look at, you know, the use of cannabis compared to the use of other substances, you know, we see a lot of positives coming out of cannabis.
Well, I'm all for it. And I'm all for taking the two themes you mentioned and marrying them together. Obviously, Larry and I make a Wednesday afternoon habit of doing the same. But, you know, what I'll say even more is that, you know, you picked the right combination of songs to put in the title of your, put in the title of your shop. So, you know, I could talk Scarlet Fires all day. And in fact, I've often been known to. So, you know, when we got the chance to have you on, I'm like, all right, this one's going to be fun because, you know, we can discuss our favorites.
It was certainly a great Scarlet Fire that you opened with. I mean, it sounded like it was tough to really make the sound, whether it was like percussion and keyboards, but certainly, you know, Brent either ate his Wheaties or got a new toy that day.
Yeah.
No question about it. And, you know, it look, we've covered a lot of different shows. We've covered a lot of different themes. You know, there's strong arguments to be made, you know, for the majesty of a good morning dew, right? And you can, it's a song, one note in from Jerry, and we all know exactly what he's playing. You know, there's nothing else needed. And you're like, wow, 10 minutes, this is going to be great. Go for it, Jerry. Just, you know, blow our minds. But at the end of the day, if you really want to capture the true spirit of the Grateful Dead, the kind of nonstop party with a little bit of a purpose, maybe. Is there a tune, or combination of tunes greater than Scarlet Fire? When you hear Scarlet Fire opening a set, does that not send a message to you that, you know, can't be perfect every time, and we'll talk about that in a minute or two, but, you know, you hear a Scarlet Fire opening up a show or opening up a set, and you got to believe you're in for a night, right? It's that kind of gets you up on your feet. It's just...
And I think that's absolutely correct. I also think you could tell a lot about the Scarlet Fire from the intro, because if you listen to intros throughout the years, there are little changes and little subtleties about the intro, especially Bobby's part. Bobby's part changed over the years in that intro, but you know... It's almost like they're putting together like this gooey cauldron of smoky Grateful Dead, right? And you're just waiting for that magic to pop out of that cauldron. And so Scarlet Fire, that intro to Scarlet Fire, like to me is like so grabbing.
That is a perfect segue for us to play another clip of Scarlet Fire. So let's jump into a little bit of 4/15/88 from Rosemont Horizon, which, you know, we're sort of taking this incrementally through, David, to play different parts of the song. But, you know, let's stick with the intro for a little bit longer and listen to another one that's completely contrasting to the 83 one we just heard. You picked that one for a pretty specific reason, right? What's the unique feature of that Scarlet Fire?
I was at the Rosemont Horizon on April 15th, 1998. They came out and they opened it. It was amazing. I never heard a show open with Scarlet Fire. Farewell to Winterland technically opens with Sugar Mag into Scarlet Fire. And I had seen them do that, but only in the second set. But this, you know, but here's the part about this that really is magical. And Dave, I think this ties into exactly what you were just saying a second ago. This was 1 year after I had graduated from law school, and I had spent my third year of law school living in Chicago. I had transferred up here to go to school, and I wound up living for a semester with these guys who were doctors, really nice guys. They were the same year as me, and they had a really cool apartment down in the city right over my buddy Harold's ice cream store on the north side. And you know, we'd hang up there all night and party, and go down, and Harold would feed us ice cream, and it was great. So these guys loved to party. They liked to do a lot of things, including throwing goldfish into a tank with piranhas late at night and watching what would happen. So that was kind of crazy too. But they always gave me grief about the Grateful Dead. You know, they listened to whatever the current music was. And even though we agreed on everything else, we could not agree on the Grateful Dead. So after I had graduated and they were in their last year of medical school, the Dead came to do these shows at the Horizon. I grabbed some extra tickets and I said to them, guys, I really want you to come with me to the show. They said, great. We go, we head out there, and I'm thinking, you know, if this is like one of those shows that starts off flat or where Jerry's just not hitting it right away, these guys might be lost 10 minutes into it and not have the stamina for a show. And we walk in, and we're sitting kind of on the lower level of the Rosemont, but over on the side a little bit, had lots of room. They come out and open with this thing, and about 30 minutes later when they're done, my buddies turn to me, and their jaws are on the floor, and they're like, why did you ever tell us about these guys? This is amazing. And I'm thinking, you know, partly you want to tell them, well, it's not like this every night, but you're like, screw that. It is like this every night, you know, or at least the anticipation of it. And it, you know, they had a great time that night all the way through to the very end. And Dr. Dave and Dr. Al thinking about you guys. And it was a great night and glad you could share it with me. But it's amazing to listen. You could hear the crowd too. And right when they go into Scarlet and the crowd is like, wow, this is unexpected, and it was a lot of fun. Right.
What I sort of heard from listening to that clip was the Bobby part, right? But you know, in sort of the mid late 80s, a complaint that I have is I think Bobby at times is too low in the mix, right? But in there, you could really hear that, and the way what Bobby plays in Scarlet at the beginning of Scarlet and throughout Scarlet is really, really, really interesting. And the more I think he really lays that foundation for Jerry. So the more interesting you can hear Bobby play, you know that Scarlet Fire's really got potential. So I can't wait till when we're done. I'm going to go and listen to that Scarlet Fire in particular.
You know, it's really funny you say that, because I always think the same thing about, you know, kind of going into Fire as well. Because, like, I think so many people think that it's Garcia that does the bam, ba bam, bam, ba bam, ba da 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 da, and that's all Bobby. Like, and you don't realize that until you hear Jerry kick into the first licks of the bam, bam, da da
da da da da da. Exactly.
So it's a misconception, and people forget that Bobby can play lead. You know, Bobby has the chops to play, you know, relatively technical licks. And Scarlet Fire is one of the few places where he's always able to showcase that, because, you know, Garcia overlays already technical licks with even more technical licks.
And I think Phil comes in with some melodic counterpoint in both the jam between Scarlet and Fire and in Fire, which really makes, you know, almost this triangle, this amazing triangle between Jerry, Bobby, and Phil, that when they really hit it, it's like three minds just merge into one.
Yeah, how did Garcia describe it in the Hugh Hefner interview when he's talking about the drummers? You know, it's the dragon chasing its tail.
Right, yeah, right. It's something about a dragon with a big ugly beast, you know, out there, you know, coming at everybody. And it's true, when the dead are hot like that, boy. You know, one of the ones that we're not going to listen to today, but that, you know, I just always remember very fondly, was the 20th anniversary shows in Berkeley at the Greek in 1985. And the third night, after two really great first shows, third night they came out and they opened up the second set with Scarlet Fire. And I'm thinking, boy, here I am, you know, 25, 30 shows into it. I'm peeking at the Greek. I'm right here in the bowl checking them out. And it just, there was nothing else they could have played at that moment other than Scarlet Fire. And they did. And it just, you know, that's when you kind of have this connection, this feeling like this is a special moment, and they lived up to it more than you could hope. And the fact that they then later on reintroduced That's It for the other one in that show was also very special. But, you know, the Scarlet Fire set the tone.
And I think playing it first sends a real message to everyone. Like, we're here tonight. I obviously never heard Grateful Dead open with Scarlet Fire, but I seem to recall the second night at Folsom Field in 2019, Dead & Company opened with Scarlet Fire. And I remember before that night saying, gosh, they got a lot of big, how are they going to fit all of these big second set songs they still got to play the last night? And they opened with Scarlet Fire. I said, well, that's one way of doing it.
Absolutely. But look, you know, as we talked about a little bit earlier, as we alluded to and have to point out here, they did come out of this absolutely amazing Scarlet Fire and head right into Walking Blues. And I love Bob Weir, and I love the fact that he covers these, you know, this parade of blues tunes, Little Red Rooster and C.C. Rider and Minglewood Blues and Walking Blues, and they're all great tunes. And, you know, look, if all they do is play Scarlet Fire, that's good enough for me, you know, but anything they play after that is great. But there's a part of you that says, well, if you're going to open with Scarlet Fire, maybe you'll then do an Estimated Eyes. Why not? You know, if we're going to really blow the roof off of this thing, right. You've laid the predicate for it. How many times are we even going to get the Scarlet Fire? But I will say that that my doctor buddies were very happy throughout the rest of the show, and everybody was, because it just created such a good positive vibe for the entire evening that they really could have played just about anything. We would have been happy. But they really did follow through with a strong performance, and it was really, really great to hear.
You know, I think it also goes to, like, you know, kind of your Grateful Dead experience. Like you saying, you bring your doctor buddies to a show, and their first show they got a Scarlet Fire. I think that completely changes kind of your attitude about going to see the band for the first time. And personally, I didn't get to see a Scarlet Fire until my 15th show, and I got completely screwed that on my 7th show they played a Scarlet Estimated, which, you know, never happens. And so, like, you know, the Scarlet kicks off. I'm like, I'm finally getting the Scarlet Fire. But David, you got a Scarlet Fire your first show, which I think you said was 6/19/91. Is that right?
I did 6/19/91 at Pine Knob, which is now again called Pine Knob. It was the DT Energy Center or something for a while, but it's nice to see them.
Clarkston, Michigan, right?
Yeah, in Clarkston. It's nice to see, like, the old venue names coming back. Like, it was really nice to see that change. I don't entirely remember the experience. I know I had a great time, but going back and listening to that 6/19/91 Scarlet Fire, it really is an amazing Scarlet Fire. It comes out of Victim of Crime, but in my opinion, from the Vince years, it you know, it's the best, or maybe the in the top five of Scarlet Fires during the Vince years?
So I'll tell you something funny. My first Scarlet Fire was a Victim Scarlet Fire also, and that was from 9-10-90 in Philly at the Philly Spectrum. I think it's rare to have two people on the show that say their first Scarlet Fire was a Victim Scarlet Fire.
It was a victim. There you go. It was a Victim Scarlet.
Well, I will say, I'll get back to that point in a minute, but in 1984, Red Rocks, the first night, they did a Scarlet Victim. It was a Scarlet Bobby something, maybe a Scarlet Going to Hell in a Bucket. Whatever it was not Scarlet Fire. There was that little period of time where they would throw in different tunes, and then eventually they just came back to Scarlet Fire. My first Scarlet Fire, which we're going to listen to a little bit of here in a second as our third clip. And then after this, I promise no more about shows that I was at, just, you know, really good Grateful Dead Scarlet Fires from the old days. But this one was at Poplar Creek in Hoffman Estates, which was just west of Chicago. And Poplar Creek was this very, very nice outdoor shed that was actually lovely. It was easy to get to from the city. It had really decent parking. The hill was, you know, very friendly, not unlike the one at Deer Creek, you know, where it wasn't too steep and plenty of room for people to hang out. But then lo and behold, the Dead played there one summer. And the next thing we knew, Sears stepped in and bought all the property and turned it into a Sears Center and some sort of an arena that nobody ever went to. And after that, the Dead were up at Alpine Valley on a pretty much regular basis. But this year we went to see them at Poplar Creek in 83. It was the first time I had gone on tour. So I saw Madison, went up to St. Paul, and then came back down to Chicago to catch the two last shows of the tour at Poplar Creek. And the first night on June 27th, 83, which was my seventh show, they came out for the second set. They hit right into Scarlet. We were all my whole group of buddies were all there. My friend Andy Greenberg, who's been on the show, I believe was there. My friend Steve and Jimmy, my good buddy Harold, Tommy, Dee Dee, Janet. You know, these are the people who are like, you know, the center of my Grateful Dead life. And there we were. Some of them had seen a Scarlet Fire before. I had not. So for me, it was particularly meaningful, and to get to see it with all these guys was even better. So Dan, go ahead, and we can talk more about it in a minute. Let's listen to what it sounded like on June 27th, 1983. All I can tell you is it still puts on my face the exact, I'm sure, the smile the same size I had that entire night. There were plenty of other things going on in my head to make sure I had a big smile on my face, but, you know, they showed up, they played I was waiting for a Scarlet Fire, waiting, and there it was. We were all dancing around up on the hill, just like, it doesn't get any better than this, does it? This is as good as it could possibly be, and just a great night and another, you know, version of Scarlet Fire that just leaves you with a smile.
I think you can really hear some ferociousness in Jerry's playing, and that when it comes to Scarlet Fires are my favorite is when you can sort of hear, like, you know, Jerry grinding his teeth while he's playing and he's really trying to move that train along just on the edge of its tracks.
Well, that's what it felt like that whole night. I'm sorry, Robbie. That's what it felt like, right? I mean, your first Scarlet Fire, you know, your brain is all turned on and ready to go. And it just, you know, at the time, I imagine this must be the greatest Scarlet Fire of all time. And, you know, that point is debatable. But certainly at that night and at that moment, it felt like it. You know, the first time you hear a tune and they didn't disappoint. It wasn't flat. It wasn't anything. They just came out and blew our heads off. It was amazing.
That's always the best. That's always the best kind of show. I like to think of Grateful Dead songs not as just songs, but you know, and I guess I had this. I can't believe I'm actually telling the story, but I had this sort of I guess, idea in my head. Like I was tripping balls one show, and I'm looking out, they're not songs. They're like these beautiful, majestic beasts, right? And sometimes they parade across the stage and they show these magnificent colors and they're smiling and they have personality. And sometimes they're shy and sometimes they're sad. And sometimes they just don't feel like coming out. And sometimes maybe they never should have come out. They're living, breathing things. They're not songs. They're not, I don't even know how to describe it, but sometimes they show just snippets of incredible beauty. Sometimes the whole thing is magnificent. And sometimes you got to sort of peek around the corners to find what's really interesting.
Well, I think that's one reason that, you know, anyone that's a true aficionado of the combination loves the combination so much, because it can take you in so many different directions. You've got the common theme, you kind of know what you're in for with the opening notes, and you know how it's going to, you know, oftentimes going to end, depending on which ending they do a fire. But everything in between, you've got absolutely no idea. And obviously, like, you know, Scarlet, I think, is a bit more formulaic than Fire is, but Fire can go in so many different directions, starting with the transition jam and then the three major jams after each verse. But each time, it's a completely different journey. No matter how many times you've listened to it before, like you can't predict how it's going to go. And again, with a aid of psychedelics, it can certainly be a hell of a lot more fun as you're going down that journey. So far we've listened to a lot of Scarlet. We haven't really gotten into a Fire yet, but just out of curiosity for both you guys, are you bigger fans of Scarlet, bigger fans of Fire, or bigger fans of the transition jam? And do you get as like the hair on the back of your neck standing up when you hear the first notes where you know the fire has started?
I think so. That's a tough question to answer. I like all three parts of it exactly the same, and it would be show by show dependent on which part I like better. There are two parts that really, there's, I guess, three parts in the whole, maybe four parts in the whole sort of three part beat that really get my goosebumps. That really get my goosebumps going. One is the jam in Scarlet, like when it feels like the band is just moving and just like pushing like a locomotive on a train, and that train is going around a corner and it's just about to fall off, and they keep it on, right? And I'm like, oh my god, that's just gonna fall off the rails, and they keep it together and they come back, and it's just like, wow, it's just that, to me, that's the Grateful Dead. And in the transition, the transitions that I like the best are the ones where they really go out there on a journey, and you're thinking, how the hell are they going to get back? How are they going to find fire out of this? And so the deeper they go into you know, finding that jam space, and the farther out of the cosmos they got to come to bring it back into fire, to me is really exciting. And I love when Phil does the bass at the beginning of Fire. To me that's bone chilling. I just love the way Phil comes in with the bass on top of everything, and really, really pounds out that rhythm.
So I'll say that in the Scarlet, the period before The Wind in the Willows, like, I agree, like, for me, like, that one, if they go the extra four bars, so you're not sure if they will or they won't, but the great ones, they always do. Just when you think it's coming back in, the band's going to step forward to the microphone, and they step back instead, and you're like, yeah, we're going to get four more bars. I think the best example of that non-Grateful Dead is, or sort of quasi-Grateful Dead, is when Trey did it with them in Chicago. And if you actually get to watch the Trey camera from Fairly Well, you'll see him look over at Phil, and Phil gives the nod to say, keep going. And Trey gives the biggest smile, steps back, and just lights up and tears into the next four bars. And that, to me, like, it's like, you can't really encapsulate what it feels like to be a member of the Grateful Dead for a few nights better than how he kind of looked at it, going, please, you know, do I get this chance? Do I get the chance just to tear the roof off this thing? And then just nails it, which is something that, like, we watched for Garcia to do all the time. You'd sort of look around and be like, all right, is he stepping back up to the mic in the Scarlet? And if he didn't, you're like, all right, this is, you know, it set the tone for, like, how's it going to be going into the transition jam? How's it going to be going into the fire? And I absolutely love that.
I agree. You know, look, it's arguably, I guess, right up there, right, with Help Slip Frank. It's, you know, it's one of the greatest musical combinations that they have. And certainly, you know, very much of our generation, since, you know, we all missed the 1969, you know, jams of, you know, with all that stuff with Dark Star into St. Stephen into the 11. And those could be the highlights of a show, but there's nothing like a Scarlet Fire. There just isn't. And it, you know, to me, Scarlet is just, it's a happy song. It's a, you know, it's a beautiful song. It's a fun song. It has great energy in it. And, you know, they're just up there doing their thing. The build up to Wind of the Willows is always for me what gets the hair on the back of my neck up. That's the part where that musical lead into that, and then them just all jumping in and singing it, and Sky Was Yellow and the Sun Was Blue. It's just, you know, the lyrics, everything about it is just amazing at that point. It's really Hunter Garcia and all the guys in the band, you know, just at their finest, all hitting on the same cylinder. Fire on the Mountain for me is all about the music, the way they play the song and the way it goes up and the way it comes down and the bump, 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 that, you know, the sound that he makes all the way through. And it's just absolutely amazing. And of course, you know, I have to throw in there that another big part of the song On Fire is Jerry's singing, right? You know, there's a dragon who's loose on the town, need a whole pail of water just to cool down. It's great. It's a wonderful lyric by Hunter, but, you know, Garcia, just on the nights when he's on, man, I listened for that lyric.
By Mickey.
Well, excuse me. Right. Mickey wrote the lyrics on this one. That's correct. That's true. He did play a big role in writing this one, Mickey Hart.
One of the things that's really interesting about Fire is that, and you hear this on some Grateful Dead songs more than others, but there's a piece of it, I think, in almost everything they play, but in Fire in particular, and that is every musician on stage is playing something entirely different. And if you listen to that piece alone, it would make very little musical sense. But when you put it together, right, all of these different pieces, it creates this amazing groove, right? And it's just moving and moving and moving, and it feels like it's like a living thing that's moving. And I think both combinations are, the combination of both songs are very special, but I love the way Fire is really just a groove of multiple very different parts.
No doubt. Very well said. It's just, yeah. It is. It's the perfect example of the Grateful Dead having a musical conversation on stage. You're right.
And yeah, I agree.
And Fire on the Mountain is only two chords, right? I mean, that's probably the most interesting part about it, is you can take something so simple and make it so, and I guess deep is the right word, because there's a lot of depth in Fire on the Mountain.
Density. They make it very dense, you know, but in a good way, you know, when they're playing it and you realize they're not done going, you can go deeper and deeper and deeper before they're going to start working their way out of this. And, you know, that's right. Isn't that always the best part? The anticipation of anything the Grateful Dead is going to do. What song are they going to play next? And once they start playing it, how are they going to play
it? Exactly.
And, you know, we've heard different ways and we've heard different styles. And, you know, there's just some of those nights where they're like, screw everything, man. We're just going to play this song the way it was meant to be played. And they blow the doors off. And, you know, these clips that we've been listening to up to this point, I think have just been great examples. But I am very excited, you know, as sad as it always is to leave Scarlet, you do it with a smile on your face because you're about to run into your good buddy Fire on the Mountain, and the little bridge getting you from one to the other sometimes is worth the price of admission alone. So, Rob, why don't you lead us into this next clip here?
Well, the next one to me is the quintessential transition jam between A Scarlet and a Fire. And it's from 11:30, 1980 from the Fox Theater in Atlanta, Georgia. And this transition, it is definitely deep. And it definitely does everything that David says it does as far as every member of the band firing on all cylinders. And then going into the moment that I think, you know, for many people is the moment they wait for, which is the opening notes of Fire, which is kind of that release that you get of just like, all right, here we go. Like, let's move from one to the other. And it's kind of like that second where I think collectively the entire audience breathes a sigh together going, all right, you know, it's on. So Dan, let's fire up a little bit of the Fox Theater from 1980. Thank you. And there's that bass line that you're talking about, David. That's, you know, Phil just dropping it in so heavy as Garcia comes in to take the opening licks.
What's really interesting is that right before he does that, Phil's playing this, and I've never heard that before, but it's this really sort of bizarre, like, three-note bass line. Usually Phil plays in very long phrases. And then it just, it's like, it's kind of like Phil almost pushes Jerry into fire, right? But Jerry's like, I think if Phil had just kept on that three note little bass beat, Jerry would have gone off to Never Never Land. But then they brought it back. But that was a really nice transition.
And Rob, the thought that occurred to me just as you were saying it, as we went into this clip, is this idea of a sigh of relief. You know, we've talked, you know, we were talking a few minutes ago about occasions when they come out of fire and, or excuse me, out of Scarlet, and, you know, just to kind of keep things interesting, maybe they would go into a quick Bobby tune, and sometimes they'd come back around to fire. Sometimes they wouldn't, as they would on, you know, occasionally wander off on other tunes and forget to play the follow-ups. But it's one of those things where, you know, when I was growing up, I never understood why, if I was throwing a baseball, why it mattered what my arm did once the ball left my hand, right? And once the ball leaves my hand, who cares if I just stop my hand there? But yet somehow, right, it does. It affects the ball. You have to do the complete and total follow through to get the whole effect. They can play the most amazing Scarlet Begonias for me in the world, but if there's not a fire on the mountain immediately following it, it somehow just doesn't feel, and while I look, it's their music and I, you know, applaud them and had fun when, you know, the couple of times when I was there and they veered off in another direction and kind of shook you out of what you expected to hear. There's no replacement, you know, from a hot Scarlet Begonias into a hot fire on the mountain. And yes, it's like a good sigh of relief. Here we go. Just like Rob said, you hear those notes, they're committed. Now they're in. They're not going anywhere else. We're hearing Fire on the Mountain.
I think Scarlet Fire is kind of like, to me, it's almost like a married couple, right? You know, so when the fire doesn't come after the Scarlet, it means the two are arguing or they just shouldn't be played together, right? You know, on some days, it's just amazing. Every part of it is amazing. And it's a couple in paradise, right? And I think when you know, and this is getting into my crazy head, but I used to think that, you know, yeah, just fire just didn't want to sit beside Scarlet that day.
Well, I only had it broken up twice. I said my first one was a Scarlet Estimated. And then in 1993 at Cal Expo, I saw Picasso Moon Fire. And, you know, I was grateful for the fire. Don't get me wrong. You know, I was thrilled to get the fire, but you know, you're kind of like, where's the Scarlet? But it's a lot worse the other way around. If you get a Scarlet and Estimated, you're waiting during the transition jam, and all of a sudden you're like, what the hell is this? So, like, why am I not getting my fire? The only way that I think it's acceptable is what they did in 1991 at the Boston Garden when they played Help's at Fire, where, you know, just as you're waiting, because I feel the same way about the release going into Franklin's. You're waiting for those first, like, you know, opening notes of Franklin's. But instead, they fool you and give you the opening notes of Fire, where there's sort of that moment of the whole crowd's confusion of like, wait, what's going on here? And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, whoa, this is something that's ridiculously cool and special.
Yeah, I always get a little bit annoyed when I get a Franklin's alone, right? I call them misplaced Franklin's. Because I'm like, where's my help? There's my help on the way in Slipknot, right? I just don't want Franklin's. I want everything before that.
But Half Step Franklin's were a really popular opening for them for a long time.
Right.
So it was Feel Like a Franklin's. Feel Like a Franklin's was probably, yeah, it's hit all the time.
Yeah, Feel Franklin's was big around 1980.
Now, I will tell you, though, you're talking about the importance of the two and being in balance, which I do agree with. But if you listen to them in Egypt from 1978, the night when they play Fire, and it's just... It must be because they were by the pyramids and the sound and everything. And what I really love about that more than anything is after this beautiful fire, they have what is my personal favorite all-time Grateful Dead transition from that fire into Iko. And it's just absolutely mind-blowing. And, you know, all I could think about is, what would it be like to be standing there in front of the pyramids, tripping, listening to the Grateful Dead right now? And I can't imagine, you know, what vibes are coming out to people from that. But that was one example of Fire on the Mountain.
That fire is so cool. It's got, that one's the one's got all the scratchy noises going on, right? Like really cool, like scrape noises.
Yeah, all sorts of great stuff. You know, they knew where they were and they were playing it up. So that is certainly one fire that can stand alone. But yeah, you know, so much about the Grateful Dead was balance, right? How many times did you go to a show where they played Plane and they didn't come back to do the reprise. And you're like, okay, well, I'm going to the next night. I'll catch it there. And they didn't do it the next night. And then maybe four nights later in the middle of nowhere, they bring out the reprise. You know, at least I got to give Phish credit on a night when they played Tweezer Boy. They put the reprise right in the encore. They don't make you wait.
They're going to play Tweezer Reprise, yeah. Yeah, but I like the shows where they'll play one verse of the other one night, one verse the next night, and they'll shake things up. I like that. I did the I did the Europe Rat Dog tour in 2002 or 2003, and Bobby did a ton of that all through the 2002 tour, just sort of breaking up songs from show to show and city to city. I really like that.
Well, you know, it is fun, especially if you have the ticket to be in the next show, right? So you can hear the rest of it, and when it pops back in, there's no doubt about it. And you know, for me, it's like anything else. As much as on any given night, I just like to hear a straight Scarlet Fire. You know, that's part of what keeps the Grateful Dead fun, right? Is you just don't know what they're going to play.
It's the unpredictability. That's my favorite part of it.
Right. If they're going to throw something else in there, that's why we all go. If you knew what they were going to do, it would be nice and it would be fun, but it wouldn't be that same surprise just where you're going in one direction and boom, they just take you completely the other way.
Right. And I, people, have mixed feelings about Dead & Company, but it's one of the things I like about Dead & Company is the unpredictability, right? They'll do things that, I saw a show in Columbus. It was China Cat, If I Had the World to Give, Rider. Right? And I was like, it was kind of like we interrupt the show to bring you O'Teal Burbridge, right? Now back to our regular schedule programming. When they can do that, I mean, it's taking risks, kind of moving songs a little bit out of place, but when they can do that and they do it right, it's just the creation of a set list is just as important as the creation of a song.
And I think that's been true throughout all of their, various derivations, right? Some of them further, I saw two further shows, one at the Auditorium Theater in Chicago in 2010, and then another one a year or two later out at Mill Valley. And both nights, the one in Chicago, in one show, they did play all three. They closed the first set with China Rider. They opened the second set with Scarlet Fire, and they closed the show with Help Slip Frank. And, it was – and everything, they did Born Cross-Eyed into New Potato Caboose and St. Stephen into the 11, and they threw in a Viola Lee Blues. It was just one of those nights when you think –
Yeah, I saw a show, they came out of space in Days Between and then did China Cat Rider, right? Like that,
sure.
That's a show because it throws you right off from what you can expect.
Absolutely. It adds such, to hear them come out. I saw one of the shows where they opened the entire show with Deal. I mean, Deal is a first set closer, always has been, always will be. And here they are opening the damn show with it. I was like, okay, why not? They got the crowd up and moving. Good for them. That works for me.
It's great. And then the other thing is that songs you haven't heard in like years are such a long time. Right. A show is such a personal experience. And I went 21 years of seeing shows without seeing Morning Dew. 21 years.
I'm so sorry to hear that, man.
Like you heard the one note, right? That good.
Wow.
Exactly, right? And I remember saying they played the other one, and I was like seeing the other one saying, if they're going to play Morning Dew, it's going to be next, right? To me, that show may not be amazing for everyone, but when you see something like you haven't seen in years or, 20 shows – It's a mind blowing experience.
So does that mean you never saw Garcia Morning Dew?
I never saw Garcia Morning Dew.
Wow.
Yeah, never. My first show was in 1991, and I did not see Morning Dew until September of 2013 at Red Rocks. But further, it was actually Branford Marsalis came out in that set.
Wow.
Right. Wow.
That's a crazy stat, David. I always love hearing people's special stats. That one for me is a mind blower.
Yeah. I was 22 years.
How many Grateful Dead shows did you see with Garcia?
I don't know, but I know I had fun at every one of them.
But more than 20, you think?
I probably around 20, 20, 25, 30, somewhere between 20 and 30. I was, I, it's at, in 1990, I was 17. So I that's when I saw my first show. And then when Jerry died in 95, I was almost 23. So
no, I mean, that makes sense. You can 20 Grateful Dead shows and you see them sporadically. You could definitely miss Morning Dew. That's
But it was always like, I would see it the night was the night before, the night after.
Of course. That's when you're chasing a tune, that's what happens. It took me 80 shows to see High Times, but you know, it's just,
I was chasing tunes. The only tune I really chased that I wanted to see Broke Down Palace, which is why I went to October 3rd, 94. Cause I figured they would do Broke Down Palace. Little did I know they'd also do Addicts on My Life that night. It was the only time I saw Addicts, and that was very special.
Yep. Rob, you caught that at the Warlock shows, as I recall.
The Warlock shows that I saw were not the ones in 89. They're the ones they played in 92 at Hampton, which were also billed as the Warlocks. So I didn't get the classic, you know, 89 breakout of Dark Star Warlocks, unfortunately.
Understood. Well, it's all fun when you get it. So, yeah, that stuff is just great, too. Well, moving right along, because we are moving right along, and today, folks, if you haven't noticed, we're just playing a lot of music because this is great music, and we just can't get enough of it. In fact, you know, Rob and I each came up with about six versions ourselves, and, you know, just trying to pick which five or six out of that group we were going to do was crazy.
Yeah, and I think the next one we're going to listen to is one that I figured was going to be on your list, Larry, because it's a Chicago show, and you tend to love the Chicago shows. Now, this is just kind of pre, you know, the time when you started seeing the Grateful Dead. But, you know, we forget that the Dead didn't start playing Scarlet Fire as a combo until March 18th of 1997. And so you hear all those classic springing out of the 77s of the, you know, the greatest Scarlet Fires of all time, all the Betty Board ones that everyone, you know, talks about. But that was really when the combination was brand new. I think 78 has some of the hottest Scarlet Fires that are out there, and I think 79 does too. So, like, some of my picks were April 24th, 78, which we're about to listen to from the Horton Fieldhouse in Illinois. And also pretty close to you is that February Market Square Arena show from 79 that, you know, I would take those over almost any 77 Scarlet Fire any day. I mean, again, it's not a competition, but as far as like pure energy, the Horton Fieldhouse to me, it burns the house down. And it's the only one I can think of where at the end of the song, during, you know, kind of the repeating of the chorus, Garcia throws in a, "Let it burn, let it burn, let it burn." And, you know, that kind of just signals how hot that version was. But even earlier in the song, I think we're going to listen to, you know, one of the jams between verses right now, but let's get into a little bit of fire. And this is from 424-78, the Horton Fieldhouse. Yeah, that one's awesome. And that, David, that speaks to exactly what you were saying previously about how, you know, Bobby jumps in and plays, you know, very, very unique licks sometimes in the fire that are completely unlike anything else he does anywhere in any other versions. In that version from the Horton Fieldhouse in the fire, he just comes out with just completely unique stuff.
It does. This is just, you know, again, that's one, like in Scarlet, where I really love the build up into the Wind in the Willows. This build up into this, you know, to this final set of lyrics of the song is just as powerful, I think, where Jerry's just really cooking. And then all of a sudden, boom, they're singing again. I will say that this has always been one of my all time favorite Grateful Dead shows. It is a Dave's Picks release. I embarrassingly forget which number it is, 12 or 13, I want to say, but I don't know for sure. My son goes to Illinois State University, and from his dorm room, we can see Horton Fieldhouse. And it amazes me that this school that he's going to right now in central Illinois, you know, at one time many years ago, hosted a Grateful Dead concert. And, you know, that's the beauty of it. There's so many of these little schools on the East Coast and central United States, on the West Coast, where the Dead would just show up and play, or the Jerry Band would just show up and play, or whoever. And what's also fun about this night at Horton Fieldhouse is, even though it's April, right, so not exactly seasonal, they play one of the best Werewolves of London I've ever heard. It's just a stellar version of it. And what moved them to play it that night, I don't know. But it's a great version, and it's just a great concert in its own right, April 24th, 1978. You just happen to get a good Scarlet Fire in the process.
So here's my random question for both of you. What's the version you saw live that you'd say was the best version you saw? And then in the sort of the 10 year that you were seeing the Grateful Dead, what was the one that got away from you that you missed, that, like, you know, you heard on tape a few weeks later, a couple months later, and you're like, ah, I wish I was at that show, or you just happened to have missed it. And I'll go first. The best one I would have seen, I think, it was probably June 19th, 1994 from Autzen Stadium, which is super, super hot. And the one that got away from me is the one we're going to listen to last, which is 10/14/1994 from MSG, where every time I hear it, I'm like, how? When I was, like, pretty much on tour almost full time at that time, did I not get to see this particular Scarlet Fire? But David, what was the, I mean, obviously the first one you saw, that Pine Knob, is pretty spectacular, but any better ones that you got, that you caught, or any better ones that you missed?
So, for sure that the 6/1991 for me is the best Scarlet Fire that I've seen. Now, in you know, my Grateful Dead days, I didn't actually see a lot of Scarlet Fires. It was just one of those songs that I just kept missing. And I did see it a few times, but in terms of the one that got away, I don't know if I've ever really listened to a show or particular songs that way and said, wow, you know, I should have been there. I think I may have listened to shows and saying, you know, wow, it would have been awesome to be there. But I can't think of one in particular that I would have said, geez, I should have been there.
Okay. Well, you know, look, it's hard to necessarily say best, right? I mean, there are some of these that sound just absolutely amazing. But for me, it's not always, you know, Poplar Creek, I'll just always have a smile in my heart anytime I hear that, anywhere, anytime. It just, it resonated with me as, you know, as kind of almost completing the circle of, you know, becoming a full Deadhead. And, you know, when I got to hear St. Stephen a few months later, it was really kind of unexpected and special too. But Scarlet Fire was just really the thing that, you know, made me feel, this is it, I'm in, and it's great. You know, in terms of the one that got away, I don't know that I can pinpoint any one, but I can tell you that traditionally over the years, I was the barometer of shows, right? If we were all going to a show and I backed out at the last minute, that was the show to go see. It was guaranteed that at that moment, that was going to be a show where they were going to pull everything out and people were going to say to me, oh man, how did you miss that great show? So if I go back through my notes and, you know, which shows I made it to and I didn't, I'm sure that I'll stumble upon a number of them. But I guess I would say any missed Scarlet Fire is a lost opportunity. So, you know, you want to get to see as many of them as you can. And, you know, if your luck had you in there the night that they closed the first set with Day Job and opened the second set with, you know, Don't Ease Me In, well, that was just the way it was going to be, you know. And but, you know, when you were there on those nights when they were rolling on a Scarlet Fire, there was really, I remember, like, coming home from those shows and looking at all the other people on the highway and saying, where have you people been tonight? What have you been doing with your lives? Well, we've been hearing this amazing, amazing Scarlet Fire. What else could you possibly have been doing? And, you know, maybe that's a little silly, but that's the way I felt at the time.
That's so funny.
One of the Scarlet Fires I certainly remember distinctly was 12/27/91. In Oakland Coliseum.
That was a great one.
Yeah, it was really interesting because they did Looks Like Rain after, and then into Terrapin. And that was the first Terrapin I ever saw. And I was just, Scarlet Fire, Looks Like Rain, Terrapin. Like, I was 18 years old and I, you know, just drooling down, you know, in front of me.
Did you go for all four nights?
I got shut out of New Year's.
So you missed the Branford.
So I got shut. I didn't get the New Year's ticket. But what's really interesting is that October, Merle Saunders played in Toronto with the Rainforest Band, and he was playing in a place called Lee's Palace, which you had to be 19 and over to get in. And he was real upset about it. And so he played early in the evening at a local high school. I got to talk to him after the show, which he showed up like 3 hours late to the night show because he just spent all the time in the high school. And I'm talking to him and I said to him, you know, I was going to see the Dead in Oakland in, you know, coming up in December. And he says to me, well, why don't you come see us at the Great American Music Hall? We're playing on the 29th in between the four shows. And then he says, you know what, just let me take down your name. Just go to the box office. There are going to be four tickets for you. So I figure, like, you know, whatever, like, this guy just, the Merle Saunders talked to some like teenager in a high school gymnasium. Certainly I go to the Great American Music Hall. There's four tickets at the box office with my name on it and instructions to take me backstage. So now I was hoping Jerry was going to show up, but, you know, that was woefully wrong, but it's kind of an interesting thing. Like, you know, you're just some kid talking to Merle Saunders, and then he leaves you four tickets.
That's awesome. And that's such a great venue too. And I'm guessing that was your first time in San Francisco seeing music in the Great American Music Hall in O'Farrell.
That was my first time in San Francisco. And it was probably like my first time I went on a plane anywhere, like, without my parents. And so that was sort of a real interesting experience. And of course, you know, being a Jewish kid growing up in the burbs in Toronto, and then going to Oakland and saying, hey, let's go check out downtown Oakland and see what down. And you're like, oh yeah, maybe we should just roll up the windows and go
there's
home.
There's a little bit of culture shock.
Yeah. I mean, but look, where the Great American Music Hall is the upper part of the Tenderloin. It's not necessarily the best neighborhood either. I've been scared out of my mind, you know, late night, right around that area. But I've seen some fantastic shows in that venue. It's just one of those classic rooms. Now
it's a beautiful venue, really beautiful venue.
And obviously, everyone, every Deadhead knows it from the 1975 show that they played there.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, when I was 18, I think I was probably too young to really appreciate the historical value of where I was.
And I will just throw out, because why the heck not? A friend of the show, Max Wellens, once sat in with Carl Denson and his Tiny Universe at a show that at the Great American Music Hall. His father, also friend of the show, Alex, was having a party for his work, and Carl let his son go up on stage and jam with him, and that was pretty cool. But Rob, speaking of that, you sent.
Yeah, did you hear it happen this past week?
Yeah, that's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Yeah. I'm going to have to reach out to our good buddy Rob Bleetstein and find out about that, because he's a big Pearl Jam guy, right? But apparently their drummer was out with COVID-19, and they were sending out word that they needed a drummer. And this kid, who was 18 years old, sent an email to Eddie Vedder's daughter saying a text. He texted or tweeted or whatever the hell these kids do. And the next thing he knew, they found somebody to play the drums, but then they invited the kid up to play the new tune, Mind Your Manners, or whatever it's called. And he sent us the clip. It's absolutely amazing. Absolutely incredible to see.
Well, I think what's even cooler is that I don't think there was even like an open, like, you know, request for production kind of, you know, reach out. I think it was this kid heard that there was an issue, was going to go to the show, knew Eddie, met Eddie's daughter randomly and had her number, and just volunteered himself. Like, hey, I'll jump in. I'm happy to do it. And they actually reached back out to him and said, all right, let's, you know, can you play? And he sent in, something of himself playing. And they said, all right, meet us before sound check. And he went out there and played. And they're like, yeah, man, you're in. Which has got to be, for a 17 or 18-year-old kid, one of the coolest things that's ever happened in your life. But anyone that hasn't seen that clip, just Google Pearl Jam COVID, teen drummer, and check it out. But this kid absolutely smashes it. And it's, you know, really, it's like what you expect to see Foo Fighters do when, you know, Dave Grohl invites people up there and out of the audience and says, come play with us. And some of the greatest clips you're going to see in music in the last 10 years are when the Foo Fighters have done that. But, you know, sort of taking a page out of the same book, Eddie Vedder and the Pearl Jam crew saying, hey, come on up and play with us. I figured you'd appreciate it, which is why I sent that to you earlier this week, Larry.
That's amazing. I mean, one thing to meet your hero. It's another thing to play with your hero, right?
Oh, and they were so supportive of him. I think his name was Kia, right? He gets up behind the drum kit. He goes, everyone, this is Kia. Kia, this is everyone. Okay, kid, it's your band. Let's go. And the kid just sits there, balls of steel, boop, boop, boop. And he knew when to stop. He knew when to play. And the guitar, they were all, you know, the Stone Gossard kept going up to him. They all kept, you know, going up to him. And Eddie Vedder at one point went back there. And this kid looked cool as a cucumber. I couldn't have been more impressed.
That's amazing. And I remember the first time I met Bob Weir, and I was like shaking like a leaf, right? I just looked at Bobby and I said, you know, this, for me, this is like the first time you met Willie Dixon.
Yeah.
I felt like, wow, that was a really stupid thing to say. So how you could be cool as a cucumber, you know, playing with your musical heroes is pretty amazing.
Well, if you guys get the chance, Google Yayo Sanchez, spelled Y-A-Y-O. Yayo Sanchez playing with Foo Fighters on Monkey Wrench.
Oh, yeah?
And you want to talk about someone that gets picked out of the audience where literally by the end of it, the entire band was like, you know, bowing down and praising him, saying, you know, we've invited a lot of people on the stage. We have never seen anyone come up here and just like absolutely take over the stage the way you did. I mean, the guy could have like jumped in and played the rest of the Pearl Jam or the rest of the Foo Fighters concert and not missed a beat.
Nice.
Just exceptional.
Yeah. No, it's great to see. It's nice to know there's so much talent out there, and, you know, and it's always fun when, you know, who was it? There was a 3 or 4 year old girl who got into a drum off with
Dave Grohl.
Dave Grohl, right.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, they said she won, but I saw part of it. And I have to say, Rob, you've been pushing this for a long, long time. And the other night, I just was flipping around on my computer and I finally landed on that Jimmy Fallon drum off between Will Ferrell and Chad, what's his face, from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And it, first of all, Will Ferrell's hysterical. I did not know he could really play drums like that. I mean, that was pretty freaking amazing. He more than held his own.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you see the movie Step Brothers, you know, you see that he can play there. Like, he obviously is he has a kit in that film, and I think it was picked specifically because he knew how to play the drums.
Yeah, that was another great thing talking about drummers. That was really a lot of fun to see. So, at any rate, thanks to Rob Bleetstein for bringing us up to speed on things going on in the Pearl Jam world every now and then. And that's always fun to hear too. So, well, Dave, the problem that we have here is, you know, you're a lot like us. So we could sit here and probably just keep talking for about the next 3 or 4 hours until our wives called and yelled, or Dan said it was time to go home because, you know, he can only produce for so long too. But this has just been a real treat for us. We haven't even talked about your business, which I feel bad about. Just tell us in 30 seconds or less. I need to know. Are you happy with your decision, Dave? Are you happy with that decision you made?
Well, you know, like I said earlier, you know, selling weed is a hell of a lot more fun than drafting documents. So you know, I'm often seen on a Monday morning dancing through the store, which I never did in the law firm. I think dancing was prohibited.
Never. Right, especially on a Monday.
Yeah, there you go. So we really are focused on quality. We're focused on craft and micro grow cannabis. If consumers continue to consume corporate weed, big corporate weed, the terrorists win. And that's never going to happen on my watch. I'm never going to let that happen. What's really important to me and to my staff is education, that we're teaching people about weed and about not just THC or not just CBD, but all of the compounds in the plant. Which is why we have a section in our store called Terpene Station. That's it. We have the sign. We had a replica of the sign from the album. So we have the LP sitting on one of the shelves, and then we have the big sign at the top that has a Terpene Station. And so, you know, we have people came in here all the time at the beginning and saying, "I want the weed with the highest THC you got," right? And I would say, well, you know, the highest THC isn't always the best weed. So what we wanted to do is educate people where they start coming asking for the most terpy weed.
Let's talk myrcene. Let's talk pinene. Let's talk D-limonene.
And that's starting to happen, which means we've been successful what we set out to do, which is sort of teach people about the plant and not just what we know about it, but how much we don't know about it. And what we don't know about this plant is so scary. It is so scary how little we know about it.
Well, that happens when it's a Schedule One. You know, you don't get to really learn a whole lot about it, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, you know, it is unfortunate, but you know, there's no coincidence that we have an endocannabinoid system and plants have a phytocannabinoid system, and the fact that the cannabis plant and the human body fits together like a jigsaw puzzle. The problem is that it's a 100,000 piece jigsaw puzzle, and we're trying to figure out how it all goes together. And the more we do that, the more we can, you know, advance the quality of people's lives. I really believe that.
Well, that's great. Really quickly, how do people get a hold of you?
People can get a hold of us by email, david@scarletfirecannabis.ca. We are at 3852 Bathurst Street in Toronto, two blocks north of Wilson on the west side of Bathurst. You can also visit our website, www.scarletfirecannabis.ca. We are on Instagram, Scarlet Fire Cannabis Co., and we're on Facebook and Twitter as well. And we love to hear from everybody, and we respond to everybody. So even if you have something silly to say or you got a stupid question, please say it or ask it, because we'd love to hear from everybody.
Wonderful.
Well, you heard it here first, folks, that if you're smoking anything but craft cannabis, you're smoking, you know, mass-produced regs, an angel loses his wings.
That is, I mean, it's 100% true. There is a difference in the way the plant is grown and cultivated and produced and packaged for you. And it's important for us, all of us as consumers, to raise our knowledge and awareness of what makes a product good and what makes a product not, so that we can align what we're willing to spend on what we believe the quality of the product is. And that's the way we got to marry things. We got to marry things between price and quality. They've got to be aligned. And it's consumers that really need to push for that.
Well, thank you so much, Dave Ellison, Scarlet Fire Cannabis Company in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for sharing all about your company. Thank you for sharing with us your knowledge and enthusiasm for the Grateful Dead. This has been a really fun show for me, and I'm sure for Rob too. And we're going to have you back on at some point in the future, just because it feels like we've barely scratched the surface on, you know.
I would love to come back on. I had so much fun talking to you guys, just talking about the Dead. I mean, you know, there's two things that once you get me to start talking, can't get me to stop. One's weed, the other's Grateful Dead. So
yeah, well, this is the right crew for that.
You're in good company, man.
The next time you do a 6-hour marathon show, I'm game.
Excellent. We will have you. Thank you so much. We have a great show coming up next week. Our guest is Todd McCormick. We have more great music for you, and we really look forward to it. Rob, tell us a little bit about this great clip we got teed up for the end of the show.
Well, as I said, the one that got away for me was 10/14/94, and you want to talk about layering. I suggest that everyone out there listen to the Scarlet Fire, because if you take the theme that they play during the transition jam, and then you see how they elaborate it on it after the first verse and then come back to it. They don't play it during the second jam, but in the third one, they come back and layer back in. And the culmination of kind of how this one builds, we're going to listen to the end of the fire, which is kind of just the everything put together from earlier in the transition jam and the post-first jam to absolutely give what I think is one of the greatest finales of a fire of all time. So with that, Rob Hunt signing off from sunny Southern California. Thanks so much to David Ellison. Thanks to our producer, Dan Humison, to Larry Mishkin, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, everyone. As always, Rob, it's a pleasure. Dave, thank you. Dan, thank you. Yeah, guys, just really enjoy this. Just, you know, after you're done listening to it, go find this October 14th, 94 show. Take it home, put it on, turn it up loud. When people complain, just turn it louder. And, you know, it's just that some things have to be listened at full volume. You know, some things you have to feel that fill bass vibrating out of the speakers at you. You have to feel when Garcia does something and Weir fills in the holes underneath. And, you know, let's give Vince credit where credit is due. You know, he stands up really strong here and brings in a really great addition on the keyboard. So, we will leave you with the end of our Scarlet Fire show. We will be looking for other themes in the future. Thank you, everyone. Have a great week. Be safe and enjoy your cannabis responsibly.